Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 14th, 1999, and in the fireside room we have Edna Hansen, and she will be presenting a series on our internal tree of life in our brain, life beginning. So let's go to the fireside room now for Edna and the discussion. This tape is 99-1.
My name is Edna Hansen, and I'm going to speak about the brain in relation to its beginning, and beginning of life. And I just want to say that this whole environment is pretty special, because I lectured in a lot of rooms with the steps that go up and feel. But this has some kind of metaphor in terms of the brain itself and for cells. I want you to know that being here and speaking here just a couple of days, and it's kind of like being in a state of gratitude, because everything you hear and you smell and you see acts on the sensibilities to give you this kind of sense of wonder, and it's very wonderful, and I appreciate being here very much. I became interested in the brain after I finished my educational programs and my doctorates in education as well. But I was a nurse before I was married, and that led me back to find out particularly some of the difficulties that children have in learning, because all of the education I had in the process of getting my master's and my doctorate didn't seem to come to the conclusion that there was something here related between the intellect and the process of growing, which each child goes through from birth. And then when I went back to brain research at the General Hospital in Los Angeles with Dr. Hahn, and we had neuroanatomy and neurophysiology classes, I began to see the relationship, and that it should be known how a child evolves with the modalities that are very involved with learning. And I think I would really love to have all educators in teacher training programs have courses in neuroanatomy and neurophysiology, because I know that there are some very caring individuals out there that teach, but I don't know if they recognize when vision completes maturation, which is until between seven and nine years old, or when the brain actually has been able to be cognitively structured so that they can grasp a lot of the ideas. And all of these things are pertinent to understanding ourselves. And I think that this piece of I had to give a talk to the Alternative Education Association in the state of Washington, and to teachers, and I thought the brain can be a pretty dull subject, and I have to do something. So I spent about 2 weeks creating this brain. I tried to gather the most beautiful materials, and it became a work of art, which has been, I loaned it to the Seattle's Science Museum, and I loaned it to a psychiatric hospital nurse for Auburn, Washington. It has been many places. I wouldn't make another one, though, and I've been asked. It's a long time, and I would like to show you it. I have a form at home that's very stable that my husband made me when I travel with it to schools and to the colleges when I lecture. And this, it's so bulky and so heavy that I didn't bring it. So now I filled this bottle with water to be stable enough to hold it. But we will go this way. Most of all, God gave us this wonderful, wonderful gift. Our human brain, like no other brain, and if we just appreciated it, and I know that children know very little about this magnificent piece they have here. And I go into schools and turn the whole room into a brain, and we do different sections. The left side does very intricate math puzzles, and the right side, I have three different kinds of media that they can paint or use pastels or whatever. And then the frontal area where some of the sensory information from taste and smell, not smell, but taste and touch, I have them feel some feeling boards, and also I bring about 12 different kinds of food items that taste different and have different shape and form, and let that part that is supposed to be the frontal area where about 7 children are allocated to go. They have to fix up a little place for all the rest of the brain, which we do at break time. And then the area down here in the cerebellum, I have walking beams, and I'm given permission to have a trampoline and some buckets for target practice. And then I have a group of people who will take care of the motor court. And then in the center, which we'll talk about, which is the limbic system, which is a very intricate part where all your information processing will come together. I will look around and pick about 4 students who can be the limbic system, and they sit at a table in the middle of the room with pad and pencil, and they're the reporters, and they have to go out to the different sections of the brain to get information so they can bring it back to the center and write up, this is going on. And you know that I've done this in kindergarten, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade. It doesn't matter when it's a working process. These children are just wonderful. And it goes on, you know, I mean, first grade, it will go on in the morning. That will be very busy. And actually, with the first grade time frame, I'll call after recess and they come back. We'll switch sides, and the left side will go to the right and the right side to the left, unless they want to stay where they started. And then after lunch, they will come back, and we have great big sheets of paper on each desk, and they draw the two hemispheres, the left and right side, and then they pictorially show me what they experienced. And then I get the most wonderful letters, and I have books, and I should have brought one or two. They're interpretations. I know I'm left brain. Now I know why I like to do math puzzles, because I'm, you know, there. And then another one will say, I know I'm going to be an actress because I'm right-brained. And all these wonderful insights. And I think they appreciate this gift that God gave them. And I know that even in high schools we should know this, because we realize that what we do with the chemicals within each cell can be so disturbed by any kind of derivative from, you know, from even medications, can disturb the function, and we've lost this marvelous, beautiful apparatus we have here to design buildings and create wonderful things that has been done throughout life by those who have preserved their facility up here. And I think I've done this with high school children, and they come over and they'll say, do you think I can still function? I have taken a little bit of this. And I said, cleanse yourself and try to see how it feels. And they will come back and tell me. And I've had many letters, and I did a lot of this in California. I haven't had much time since I've been in Washington. This beginning here is very much like the fetal brain in the womb. The head part of the fetus is actually down on the chest, so you see this structure here, which will become the spinal column, and it's so beautiful. And very, very early on takes on all the attributes of the human brain. And God has programmed this. And believe me, what he has done to give us what we have is just phenomenal. I mean, I know that there are ways that we should find out about our brains, but I think God wants us to know this. I went to my neuroanatomy class and wasn't really aware that we would hold brains, and we did that along the course of time. And if you ever doubted your immortality, take a neuroanatomy class, because you know that matter cannot be destroyed. And we are ultra, ultra, ultra high frequency beings. Our energy is that enormous within the brain. And when you hold the brain that has no longer life within it, and you wonder where all that energy has gone, you'll never doubt again. And Jesus said, I go to prepare a place for you. And he really has, because I have never doubted since then. I think when you grow up, you know, you wonder about it. Usually at 5 or 6, children really are concerned about death, and they will question, you know, to whoever will give them a good answer. And my grandmother told me way, way back then that I didn't worry, because God will have a place for me. Jesus is the one that will go to prepare it for me. And then when I took the neuroanatomy class, I realized, I mean, not that I needed proof, I believed her, but then it was so concrete. And I know that this has always left me in a state of wonder, just having the brain. And there's a brain-body connection that is so, so important for children. And when we begin with the fetal brain, which is what I really want to work with this morning, this is all there is. This temperature control, the cerebellum doesn't evolve. See, every time I loan it out, I have to re-Velcro it. And it was gone for about 4 weeks before I came. It doesn't evolve until later on in the neonatal period, about 6 months. And then the limbic system.
What was that you just put on that evolved?
That's the cerebellum.
Okay.
Now we're becoming able to have temperature variations in the body. And this little gland is the pituitary gland, which is the most important in the body. And more research is finding out multiple things that occur within these structures here, the hippocampus and the little, I call them amygdalas, I don't think that's the right, but they're compared to acorns, that these have a lot of meaning now in terms of emotional stability. And the hippocampus too, which is supposed to look like little seahorses, and this is as close as I could come. The two thalamuses here are separate entities joined because I had to hook them together here, have a lot to do with our endocrine system. And so we put this here, if the Velcro will work, and see all of these will be partially formed by the time this little fetus is coming to the earth, coming to this earth space. The gray matter. And then the cortex. And in the infant brain, there's a hole in the head, and I'm sure you all know that if you have had a child. Do you really know that it takes till puberty for that to really become solidified? But you don't have to worry, because the mylar, the strength of the covering is so strong that it's almost like bone, but it's not. And knowing that those things don't happen until that time, we should recognize the ongoing growth of the brain in the child, and the ability to be cognitively aware of how to make decisions. There are parts in the frontal area, and this is really something I love to tell parents who have teenagers, that does not fully evolve until you're 20, 21 years old. And this is in the area where decision making must be tremendously you know, quick and sudden. And to know that is to know that we need the mentors that will be there for guidance, and that's what we really hope for all the time. But this is the 12 yards of material. So when I first lectured with this, and the teachers, I said, do you notice anything special? And there were about 4 out of 40 that recognized there are pearls of wisdom here. Which comes with age. I think some of my pearls have left. And this is the cortex over which, when I talk to the children, it's like the skull then goes on top, which is like a helmet that you wear bicycle riding. And that's very important. And in the infant evolving in the womb, that's a very important structure that becomes one of the last, this little new brain that has already started its dendrite tree to grow, has to have, before birth, because you have a 100-pound thrust for that final emergence into this world, then you have to have a little helmet, and it's a viable piece of tissue that's very strong. The wonder of the fetal development is that as God has created us, we think of a fetus as just this little being, but the miracle is that even as early as 3 months, there is a process within the fetus to do what it has to do to survive in the outside world. And we've just discovered this. An infant is born with 10 different reflexes to survive. And one of them is the Moro reflex, which if you startle an infant, they will shoot out like this. Another one is the tonic neck reflex. I have a whole list of them. There are many, but these 10 are necessary for them to survive. I mean, God has given us this because imagine coming into this earth space after being in this capsule like an astronaut with your full systems, you know, the food you receive and the spongy surface and the watery solution where you're gently rocked back and forth. All of those are actually like an astronaut is given a whole survival system within his suit, you know, with his oxygen and the warmth that his clothing provides. So here comes this infant out into this world, and I always feel that the only thing they don't have is the support system as great as the astronaut, because I was involved with a program in California with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and learned about the fact that how they train, and they have 10 supporting members that help them to get ready for this journey. And when they're there, then they are monitored moment by moment in their in the lab, where a Jet Propulsion Lab has, you know, 50 computers, and they're all tuned in to the astronauts and what's going on, telling them what to do next. And this infant arrives, and hopefully, as God prepared us to be parents, there are two, the mother, father, and that is the life support system that will be there for this infant from then on through that first year of life. I mean, that's where I'm going today. And that is so vital to have this system with you. And I suppose it gets to the brain, but the way that the brain comes about at the time frame is very interesting, because this, as you are conceived, you're no bigger than a dot at the end of a sentence. And then you travel down a stream for about 5 days that's no bigger than a carpet thread. I'm sure everybody knows this. But it's like a mystery, a journey that we've all taken. And of course we don't remember, because it's kind of a magical thing to have become a person. So, but this was a life before you were here. After 5 days, you find this little caravan that's very soft with trundles around, and you settle back to relax a little, and now you're no bigger than, let's see, the dot has increased with almost 1,000 cells now. All cells that come through your DNA from your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents, and those before you are combined into this formula that is going to be you. And you decide to stay there because it's very comfortable. And besides, you're getting nutrients that are pretty tasty. And you're very, very, very tiny. Less than a half an inch at the second month of life. But then you keep growing, and the phenomenal growth occurs after the 6th month. The 7th month is very critical, because now you are really beginning to be aware of your situation. I'm speaking of fetus as if I know it. I've studied it so long, I feel I do. And as I said before, as we are programmed to survive, in the three and a half to 4 months, we are programmed to start exercises. And the same things we do in the outside world, we're startled. We do those things in the womb to become accustomed to what that is. And mothers really begin to feel those exercises. And you might think that it's just something, but it's very important that they do these in order to have them when they're born. And as life goes on within the womb, we become more and more wanting nutrients, and everything that our mother provides us within an hour becomes food for our umbilical cord to reach us. And all of the detriments that we should not have will also enter the bloodstream of the fetus, such as alcohol and those very spicy foods that we might like, and it will cause hiccups within the womb, and we know that they have hiccups. The thing we don't know is that they have long periods of REM sleep, and this was just discovered just a bit ago. And REM is the sleep within our cells that we dream. So can you imagine what we dream about in the womb? Isn't that wonderful? I think God gave us this ability within the womb to kind of calm us down for what's coming. Go to places unknown that are most comforting. Because as we get bigger and bigger, it gets very uncomfortable in there. And we know we have to do something to relieve the tension around us. And sometimes we don't want to. We decide maybe we won't make it. Like my 4th son decided to wait 2 longer weeks. And some of us are very anxious, and we come before the time we have been destined to come. And then finally, we're ready for that journey, and we have that final push, which is tremendous, I think, for 100 pounds to get us into this outside world. And within that capsule, where it has been very, think about the light situation, coming into the world, if you were born in the hospital, now they're beginning to realize that the impact of those ultra super surgical lights would cause anybody to scream. And when we have the home births, we find that babies do not always have to do that at all. They're very calm. And imagine, I think it's tremendous. But the thing about the reflexes, again, we should know that when we have them to survive, they are programmed to be negated, to subside, so that further neurological processing can continue to develop in this child. And as early as 6 months, most of those reflexes should be gone. Otherwise, they don't allow for the spinal column to have the neurological growth that it should, and for the dendrites to be fully developed. And we found research in Chester, England, has, for about 15 years, Dr. Blythe has looked at the situation of the leftover reflexes, because you can see children still having startle reflexes. You can still see them with tonic neck reflexes. The Landau is a back position that we see in many children in kindergarten. All of these indicate that other processes in the neurological system has not been allowed to develop. And so we come out with learning disabilities. And to think that this goes back not only to kindergarten or birth, but even into the neonatal time. So why we have to become conscious of the fact that beginnings are so vital for the rest of our life. This is what is coming now in research that we're going back further and further, that some of the attributes and attitudes that we acquire in that first year are relative to happenings in our adult life. And there are ways to deal with those differences, and that's mostly what my research is about at the center. I have taken, after my brain work at the hospital, I became a member of the Dr. Jean Ayer's Sensory Integration Dysfunction Group in California, and spent a year at Children's Hospital, where they work with these children who have the reflexes that are left over. Most of your Down's children will have them possibly through life, and even those can now be attended to, and they're doing remarkable work with Down's babies. One of the ways that we can eliminate those leftover reflexes, which many, many babies do, and if they're lucky enough to have the environment and the caregivers that understand that babies should not be in soft, cradled containers too long, that they should not be in the jumpy seats, and all of these, I want to call them mechanical, what is it?
Extra saucers.
What did you call them?
Well, they're extra saucers. They're the ones that the kids can flip around in now,
yeah,
turn directions.
They're
and
mechanical helpers. Well, they're not necessary, and actually they're detrimental to eliminating the reflexes and allowing neurological processing. The thing that will do this is for the child, the infant child, the infant baby, to be laid on a firm, hard surface. And if you've ever watched them do their thing, their little legs go a mile a minute, and their arms, and what they're doing is exercising and stimulating the neural growth in the spinal column. The woman who was trained in Budapest by Dr. Emmy Pickler, who is world famous, she died 3 years ago, and she had she took babies from the war in her beginning years, and had an orphanage, but it was so unlike an orphanage, it didn't seem to be the right word. From the little town in Budapest, in Buda, where she had Loxi Institute, she had as many mothers in the village who could give 4 hours of their time each day over the first period of life to come and attend to these infants. And the remarkable work she did would become well known all over Europe. In fact, it has now been studied that these individuals all became quite renowned. They were doctors, lawyers, etc., and that has been kept tabs on that. Magda is now in her 80s, and I met her in California 20 years ago, and I came to the in Northwest and realized that people didn't know about Magda's work, so I asked her to come up, and that was 12 years ago. Now, this year, at the center, in July, we have 2 weeks of training, and we have trained 152 teachers for university programs, and a lot of them open their own infant care centers, and it's pretty amazing because she doesn't believe in the wind-up swings and the soft ones, the ones the mothers have on their body, and this has a lot more intent because the baby can sensitize and feel the mother's heartbeat, can actually become aware of the sensitivity mother to child. But the I didn't carry any of mine in, so I don't know what it's called. The little things that are made out of plastic, you know, and then padded. And babies are in these at the mall sometimes for long times, and the same way with some of the push carriages are like that. The old-fashioned coaches had mattresses on the bottom and the baby lay flat. So that you see what's happening, and it's all because our merchandising has really become so tremendous. And I have friends that will call me and say, "Oh, I was given 2 wind-up swings at the shower." You hide them in the garage, but I don't know exactly how to tell people about this. And I said, well, get them interested in what's going on. But these reflexes can be eliminated. This is what we want to try to get across, that the natural way of being that we know without all those increments would help us to follow God's plan of growth and maturity for children. So I think that's very vital. I think that I'm supposed to ask questions. You ask questions, please. I bet we should take a little time for this, and then we'll go on to some other things within the year of the child. Can I have some?
I have a question.
Yes.
So I guess what I want to clarify, if I'm hearing this correctly, you know, there's this influx of learning disabilities in the schools.
Very much.
I don't recall that existing when I was in like elementary school. Do you think it has to do with these swings? And
I think, and I like the way Dr. Mays was so wonderful this morning, he'd say, "I'm not sure, but I think."
Okay. That's what,
the way he put it. And my mentor, Magda, that this is a very positive look at it, but it's very difficult to get past your great Toys R Us and all the other companies that produce these things. And they're made so colorful and beautiful.
And convenient.
Yes. How can we, counteract this? And this is our problem as adults. And we should think of that in terms of our newborns. I think because I work with a great many children, I don't want to talk about my center, but people will come to me with children after these hours, and I have worked with many, and I find the reflexes are there. And when I question, the very caring, loving family has provided all the tools and whatnot that comes with infant care, which includes the wind-up swings and the jumpers and the walkers. Now walkers have been outlawed, but and it's very difficult to speak to them and not have them feel guilty, because you do the best you can. I have 6 grown children. I'm still apologizing to the first one. She was wonderful. She takes care of me. Because I didn't really know what I was doing. Mm-hmm. By the time I got to number 6, it was a doll. You know, I knew exactly what to do. But I think that's us.
Another question.
Yes.
And then in the delivery process, it sounded like you were saying that it's sort of the baby that makes up their mind.
The baby has a lot to do with this, and doctors recognize this, and they hesitate now as long as possible not to induce.
I just hate it. I'm a nurse, and I just hate it. Mm-hmm. And ooh, I can't tell you how many times it happens. Uh-huh. And they go to the hospital, and the doctor induces them, and nothing happens. Mm-hmm. You know, and they end up sending the mother home. And I tell the patients, the baby will come when the baby is ready.
That's right.
So I'm correct, okay?
I think
I didn't know if I was correct, but what else do you say?
I think God has a plan for all of us. You know,
I had a question. Is there any contact between people like you who have the knowledge of this research and the toy manufacturers? Yeah. So the designers of the toys.
You know, it's interesting you ask because of Magda Gerber. I have to tell you, Magda and her family left Hungary during the revolution. And she was from a very wealthy family. And back in those days, as a young mother, you had a caregiver for your baby. But her story is she walked past the nursery door one day and heard the baby screaming. And she looked in, and the baby was just 3 months old, and the caregiver had the baby strapped on the table, was force-feeding the baby. And she dismissed the caregiver, and then she said, I know nothing. I have to find a resource. Then she went to Dr. Pickler's orphanage and said, I want to learn. So she took her baby with her, and she stayed there for many years until she came to America. When she came over here, she went to Harvard University, and they were very interested in her philosophy that she brought from Budapest, but they did not have the advantage of having infants, and Magda wanted to have infants as well as to teach. So she came to Stanford University, where she met Dr. Tom Forrest, and he was a neuropediatrician who was with the Rhys Davis Clinic there. And together, Magda and Tom Forrest founded RIE, which is R-I-E, which means Resources for Infant Educators. I can give you some information about Magda. And they, she was flying down to Los Angeles where her husband and the family were all involved with producing and writing for the movie industry. And her husband said, you know, that's not such a good idea. I only see you on the weekends. So then Dr. Forrest came down and helped her establish Rye Institute in Los Angeles. When I met Magda, I asked her to speak at a conference for me. I was setting up for a university. And because everyone in Los Angeles said the person to talk to for infant care and beginnings is Magda Gerber. And I called her and I knew she was very busy. She travels all over the world, not now, but she has. And I said, would you speak for me at this conference? And she said, what's the title? And I said, Space, Time, and Beyond the System. And she said, what? I said, well, I want people from many disciplines to come and speak about their beginnings as very successful people, leaders in, I had one pastor who wrote The Healing Energies of Music, Dr. Hal Lingerman, and I had a leading politician who was a Christian and had some great ideas, and I gathered together 7 people, and my beginning speaker was Dr. James Brenner, who wrote a book called Life is a Shared Creation, because I wanted it to start before birth. And that was fine. I had my people all lined up. I called 2 weeks before the conference, and he said, the first speaker, "Oh, I'm sorry, I have an emergency. I have to go down to Mexico, and I cannot speak for you." I understand. I was petrified, and I called my next speaker to see how much else would happen. When I talked to Magda, I said, "I just wanted to be sure you would be able to come." And she said, I said, "Because," and I explained. She said, "Why don't you call my son, Bensi?" And I said, "What does Bensi do?" "Oh, he's a physicist at Stanford." And I said, "Do you think he'd come?" She said, "Tell him I said he should come." So I called him, and he came. And he was the first speaker talking about his highly evolved life in physics and astronomy and far-out physics and the technology that goes with that, but how he had retained his humanness and love for life and God because of his mother. And then he introduced Magda. And that really solidified our friendship. And we've been friends for over 20 years. And she is the one who brought the wisdom to me after I didn't know what to do. You know, I have 6 babies and they all survived. And I found out that because I love them so dearly, and I think this is the way with most mothers, you do a lot right. It's only from the impact of the media and the merchandising that happens.
How are the children born through C-section?
There has been a lot of research about the bonding issue, you know, simply because it has been delivered that way, and they don't have that first initiation, but they've discovered that with the nurturing that comes from birth, that this can be eliminated, that there's no signs that this has anything to do with the bonding, that this is the thing they study most of all. Did bonding occur from a natural birth where they lay the baby on the mother's chest, or with a cesarean where, because of the situation, the mother has to heal and the baby, and so it's not quite as affinitive as a natural birth. But the bonding has been discovered that it happens because from the moment you have that infant in your home care, that's what is considered the essential bonding issue. I think that for the reflexes, I don't think that they've ever said that this could not affect, because when you start, whether you start from when you leave the hospital, whether it's for a, and I'm not sure how a cesarean, how that's dealt with, whether you stay, what is the period of time?
Now?
Yeah, for cesarean, it varies.
One day.
Is that
2 to 3 days.
Well, then, see, you would have the same situation of helping the baby to be, you know, on a firm surface, et cetera, and all of that. So I don't think that would be an issue at all for a difference with development. All of Magda's work, it concerns the first 2 years of life, and tomorrow I have a video of Magda, but we're going to the first year today, and I have to watch. Please ask questions when you want to, and I will stop. She knows that bonding is only one part of this relationship. And even from the very beginning, when you are diapering a baby, you have communication with this infant, even though they can't. And I love to have people do this because they know you're there. They sense the senses in the infant because they have billions of nerve cells, more than we have, and they lose half of these at the first year of life. By the first year of life, they have those cells die off to make room for the dendrite growth and the connections, the axons and the dendrites to grow off of that, so that their sensitivities are so high that they can pick up so much from the mother, from the tone of the voice, from the ability to communicate. You talk to this infant as though there were total communication, and you not to think that you don't understand. I did this with my first one. I think that's why she survived, because I was alone 3,000 miles away from my home without my mother and my friends. My husband and I did this fantastic thing on our honeymoon from New Jersey to California. And the next year I had this baby without even having settled in. And I talked to my baby because I had no one else to talk to. And when diapering time came, we used to spend a long time. This is your diaper. And I'm going to put this on you so gently you won't even cry. And I, this infant with this look, you know, and you notice this, that when you do talk to them, they, you know, and it's not a blank stare, it's a concentrated thing that is pretty miraculous. And this is one of Magda's big things in teacher training, is that diapering time is the one time that you have a chance to communicate. And you asked me a question, and I was going to tell you that she had a letter from Emma Bombeck, who had read an article that had been printed about Magda and her diapering. Mm-hmm. And Emma made a big joke of it. And it, you know, said about, ooh, this, you know, you can imagine what she wrote. And it was really funny. And Magda, bless her heart, wrote back to Emma and said, you really give me joy in my life, you know, about reading Emma's books. And I can understand how you'd feel about that. And then, of course, she got a letter back from Emma. Boy, Emma said, have I learned a lot from you? And my children are past that stage, but I have a lot of grandchildren that I can really work on. So this is, you know, it's what we are used to. And then when a new thing comes, even Emma questioned it. And I think that many, when we have the training sessions, and half of our people come from Canada, because you can get the training at my center or in Los Angeles, so it's easy for Canadians. They question this, and a lot of them have worked in daycare, infant care centers. And of course they'll say, well, how can you, even it's one adult to every three babies, how can you do the feeding and the diapering and the caregiving when you have three babies? How can you take time? You can take time. They do this at Loxi, and the ones that we have trained, and they go back to their centers, or the teachers will visit daycare centers where they will talk about this, that it works very easy, because what happens is you have a calm baby who will be much more content and won't have to be fondled as much, and it shouldn't be, because carrying the baby is not as good as having it lay and look and be in wonder about moving leaves and so forth. So it works that way too, you see.
I have a question about colic as related to cognitive function. Mm-hmm. When my daughter took her 5-day-old back to the hospital for the well baby check, Nathan had been this perfect baby, but would spend like 2 hours a day just looking around, not seeing a peep. And the nurse, on hearing that and watching it, said, this baby is going to be very hard to take care of in a few, I think she said, like in a number of days, because he is so trying to take in his environment that he's going to totally get frustrated. And we just left there saying, you know, he's perfect. He's not going to, you know, and she was absolutely right. Mm-hmm. For like a number of months, it seemed to be related somewhat to food, but I think there's also a cognitive part of that where the environment, they're trying to get still hold of it, these brighter babies that, and so they're real unsettled. Have you heard anything of that?
Well, I know that the reason that most colic occurs is the stomach, you know, mm-hmm. is in a straight line mm-hmm. and doesn't curve and be able to function properly for quite a few months. And it's amazing that milk stays down at all. Mm-hmm. Putting it down a tube that's absolutely straight. Mm-hmm. I think sensibilities in terms of infants, I know that Maka says that all of the things we're putting in front of babies now, like the little things that are hanging in front of them, is totally unnecessary. And in Loxi, in Budapest, the babies are put outside as much as possible, even in the winter months, wrapped up very warmly, because the motion of the leaves and the sensibilities are really strengthened that way, in a natural way, and not with all of the the cars now with the black and white imagery, yeah. which is
over space
is not black and white. It's not an integrated thing. We're not trying to integrate. I'm talking about segregation. You know, looking at these black and white things, I'm thinking, well, a lot has to come in terms of the rationale of what we're trying to do there. Cognitive, I was taught that cognition takes place much, much later,
okay.
you know,
okay.
that even in we're hoping that a lot of our kindergarten children can cognitively process information. Mm-hmm. I think that how old is the little one now?
He's 15 months.
He's 15 months, mm-hmm. and is he still hard to...
No, he's very easy now.
To him.
Very easy.
So there was just a brief time?
It was several months that his mom was the only one that could comfort mm-hmm. him.
Then I don't think that had much to do with his sensibilities
okay.
or the cognitive development, which mm-hmm. doesn't come along until
okay.
you know, cognition means that you're able to look at two things to go together and
mm-hmm.
really kind of make sense out of it. Mm-hmm. And if anybody has any idea, mm-hmm. tell me. But this is what I was taught, you know, about that.
Ed has a hand in the balcony.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Hi. Well, actually, this isn't what I wanted to talk about, but I have read a little bit about colic, and often it's tied to, if you're breastfeeding, to the mother's diet. Mm-hmm. And often, if you're not breastfeeding, it's the formula. That's what I've heard. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure
she...
That's
what I had always thought, so this is a totally mm-hmm. different slant mm-hmm. on it.
You know, it's difficult for moms now because our food processing, we have to read labels.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be so careful. I mean, as adults, you know, for what it will do to us, and think about a busy mother and trying to breastfeed and all of it, doesn't really have time to look at all the labels. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, if she's that new a mom, there could have been some disturbance in the acquisition of the milk that the baby received. Very difficult.
I do have a question. Okay. I'm not confused about something that you said. And I think that it makes sense that you'd want to lay the baby out and not put him in the swing and the bottom and all those things. But I can't understand the part about not holding them, because I mean, what about the I've heard that the front pack where they dangle around is kind of disorienting to them, but the sling where it's kind of like they're held onto your butt. Okay, I thought when you said soft carrier, I wasn't sure.
But you know those.
You mean those like plastic things or like buckets?
Uh-huh. It depends. Yeah. If you have a baby in for 20 minutes or a half an hour, that's not going to do a thing. But I have been to the mall with my husband getting grandparents' presents and things, and I have seen, because we have 12 grandchildren, that's a lot to buy for.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen babies there for 2 hours
oh, yeah.
in those carts.
I thought you meant that. carrying them on your body, which is
like... No, carrying the body is wonderful.
Yeah.
See, that was my question, because I, you know, like in Central America, the,
yes,
the
right,
indigenous women,
the babies
on the body.
Yeah, I had a black
woman go to the back all the time.
And
those are the happiest babies.
Yeah.
They are.
Right. Right.
Of course. And never cry. Yeah. It's there for 2 weeks. I never heard a baby cry.
Yeah.
You know, in Africa, too, they carry them in those. And you know, the mothers and the babies become so sensitive to each other. Those babies don't wear diapers.
No.
Those mothers have a sense to know when the elimination process must happen. And I have a friend in Los Angeles that has the largest collection of black literature, and she gave me a book written by a black pediatrician from Africa, and I couldn't believe, you know, that the way the bonding is so complete, and it's really from the total care.
I enjoyed that for men too, for dads.
Oh, isn't that great?
Because carrying a child like that does expand that connection. Which is interesting to me, because my child, first child, was adopted. And what is that? I would like for you to say a little bit more about this. The sensitivity you have in the first year that you lose, where does it come from? How is it developed? What is it related to? And how is it lost? I know you said about, you know, other neurological growth.
It's not the sensitivities that I might have given that too much. It's reflexes. The reflexes are left behind and should be, so that other neurological function can begin in the spinal column. Reflexes are the startle, the neck, and all the other things that we are born with to survive. Sensitivity is not something that is lost.
What was this, two times something that you're born with?
Neurons, you said.
Your neurons.
Oh, yeah. The cells in your brain. You have billions when you're born. Half of them die by the first year.
Oh, my.
And that's because you don't need them all. But that alone explains the sensitivity of our infants and those miraculous looks.
Yes.
And not that they make connections, because the dendrites haven't evolved enough. There are some for feeding, for being hungry, for sound, for impact and loud noises, all of those dendrite growths, but not for when you're talking to me. I don't understand a word you're saying, Mother, but I really like your expression and your soft voice, you know, and all of the attention you're giving me. But it's the cells we lose. And because we have to make room for this growth that comes from every cell, shoots out an axon, from that the dendrites grow and connect. The more connections you make, the more the brain evolves. And now they know that it never stops. Every time you do something new.
And what did you mean when you said you see those reflexes in children that haven't been freed?
Oh, yeah. A lot of them at school will have the tonic neck reflex.
From ticks in primary school.
Ticks are another name for it.
Okay.
Yeah. Involuntary.
That's another name for them. I have a list here. There's a book, a wonderful book, that Dr. Blythe and his, now she's married to him, Sally Goddard, wrote, called A Window into a Child's Mind. I have the book here. You can certainly look at it. And they have pictures of all the reflexes and the baby in the positions. And then alongside is the time when they should have dissolve and dissipate, and then there's another column of showing the attributes that might be left because they did not leave, you know, such as awkwardness, hesitancy for climbing. There's so many related to each reflex. And what they're doing now in Chester, England, at the Neurological Center, is finding ways through sensory integration therapy to undo those, and it works. So there, God has provided solutions for us all along the way. And I did volunteer at the Sabin School for emotionally and physically disturbed children in Los Angeles. Anybody here from Los Angeles? Oh, really? You know the Sabin School?
I actually some quite well. Yeah, I don't know.
One of the largest facilities, and it's wonderful. The caregivers there are saints. And I was there for one day a week for a month and a half, and you have to be a special kind of person because my heart was so, I'd come out of there and I'd take me 2 days to recover. But I realized that in every child, even the spina bifida children, the ones that have the encephalitic, you know, water in the brain, a big head, a tiny little body in a high chair, this little girl's 11 years old, and yet these children have gifts. And this one little one I can never forget, she was, you know, confined in this chair because she couldn't walk. And her body was very small and her head was large. Very bright eyes, very intelligent little person. She had ways when another child would come over to her to entice them to stay and play a game. And she was wonderful. I wrote this all down. And I couldn't believe this. And every one of the children in whatever state they were in, inside of them was a real wonderful human being. It was the outer trappings that had not allowed them to look normal, but that we should recognize, and this is so with cerebral palsy, you know, very bright children who cannot talk, you know, I mean, have a lot of difficulty. It gave me the insight to know that those children are totally real inside. They are what God made them. And that they're carrying this facade of what they have been given has a purpose. And we have to see that. And some of those children showed me those gifts that they have. It was just a wonderful experience. I don't know if you've ever worked with the handicapped. Of course, then the emotional disturbed child, there we are today with a problem that, and I my dear friend Marcy, who's over there, which I would like to be cloned just the one thing I would like to, and I didn't want to really say anything, that she would be doing a wonderful program. The spiritual life begins before birth. It begins with a mother and father knowing that this conception was planned by both of them, and that God is smiling down and saying, wow, there's going to be something special that I'll be able to accomplish now. And that I had an Indian friend named Oshana who has a four direction center up in Gurneyville. And we were on a panel one time and she said, and we talked aside, we got to be friends, that her father used to place his hands on her mother's abdomen and sing to her the songs that he felt. He made up the songs and sang to the mother. And she said, I was told I came out with a song, not a cry. Mm-hmm. And I think that the spiritual idea that this gift from God that you're given as a parent is just so remarkable. And you look at people and they have these little infants and they know that this is something really special. And it's sad that along the way, because I think in terms of working mothers, you know, this really is a tragedy. And I don't know whether we should do like Sweden does and support mothers for a year and give them the benefit of salary, which they do, or whether we can through the media and whatever in our churches, please have parents understand that maybe the first three or four years of life, it wouldn't be bad to just be a mother at home. And I have talked to many people. I worked in Watts with black women, and I had one woman tell me she wasn't going to let her babies be cared for by somebody else, and she had to work nights at the post office, but she was going to be home with her baby, and her husband took care of the baby at night. I thought, you know, if people want to do this, they somehow, some way, they can do it. And maybe it comes down to our pressure to have two cars and whatever. I don't know. I know some wonderful single moms, and the whole thing comes back to beginnings. That's maybe where we have to pray for a solution.
And I think I hate to then sort of stop and say, you know, stop at this point without saying there are some solutions, because I think there are a lot of working mothers who, in addition to not being able to figure out how they can work out the time to be with their children and make use of that time to be with their children, then are carrying this huge guilt trip because they've been told you really shouldn't do this.
That's right.
And I think that we've got to look at ways of supporting rather than trashing them.
Absolutely. I think that the media could do a lot more than having Working Mother magazine tell us that we can do everything.
That's right.
Boy, isn't that the truth?
I think
also there's a lot of families that have decided that the father is the best one to do the raising during the day, or the mother's working. I think that's a very nice...
That's a wonderful, wonderful idea.
And we probably should finish the formal session, but if people want to stick around.
With the first year of life, and we talked about the reflexes and the baby becoming a real person by the end of a year, now we know that there's much more going on in the brain than we ever imagined there was. It's not to say that babies can start to read at an earlier age, because although the wonderful dendrite growth and connections has been able to have children become extremely aware and bright at even a year old, doesn't mean that their vision system is complete, because it takes 7 to 9 years for that to really become able to look at words in sequence. The auditory development of the infant is coming along with a tremendous amount of differentiation to have auditory integration so they can decipher one sound from the other. That takes time. All of these things, these magical things, are going on during the first year of life. The child explores the environment. And another thing that has happened in our life right now is that we have everything made out of plastic. And there is a really special reason for that, for daycare centers, because it can be cleaned easily. In the past, these are computers. Every finger has more nerve cells than you can imagine, so that they are taking information all the time. And when a baby feels a wooden toy, it can make a comparison between that and a plastic toy, or a piece of fabric that is soft and one that is a little rough. And these things are essential if you want to talk about developing the infant in terms of intellect, because the more comparisons he can make, the more dendrites are going to grow. And this is what I have one piece of material. My husband said, "What do you want that for?" I found it at an Army surplus store, but it was a part of a heater. And it was a grill, and it had little holes like this. And there must have been, I think I filled about at least 95 of them in little rows, and my husband put a bottom under it for me, and I filled each one of them with a different kind of sensory feeling material. I put sand on glue in one of them. I put slippery plastic on one. I put fibers of every kind and description. And my little grandson from Alaska, when I finished that, now he's going to Mudd College. He graduated this year. He's going next year. But I have pictures of him with his, he was there for over an hour. He'd put a toe in each one, and then fingers, and then he kept doing this. And it was so magical for him to be getting these sensations. And this is the kind of homemade, I've made many sensory boards since then and given them to nursery schools and different places. But these are homemade things that are so vital for children to have, more than just buying a new plastic toy. Or the sounds. You know, children like to open the doors in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. Down in the, you should always have a little, whoever has a son or daughter that has, open the bottom closet there, that's their closet, and they can pull out the pots and pans. It's not just the shape and form, it's the sounds. Mm-hmm. The sounds that they can make. Every time they drop something off a tray, not because they want you to pick it up, I mean, it's, you have to do that, but it's the vibration and the sound. And they're taking this in to decipher this. Every new sensation a baby encounters is a miracle and is another growth factor in their brain. Just think of it. I look at a little 4 or 5-year-old and I can't believe what they're encountering. Can we say a prayer for a minute? And I thank you. Please, dear Father in heaven, let us all be aware that we are all the caregivers of all the babies that God has put on this earth, and that we will help and see in their faces the faces of our loved Jesus, and that we will speak kindly and have patience, and this will be our gift to them from you, dear Lord. Amen. Amen. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.